All right, everyone. We're back to I'll Cry If I Want To, events, industry, hospitality, food, comedy, anything we want to talk about, really. This show has evolved to just be me and Kevin and whatever we like.
I love it when you encapsulate things.
Oh,
you like? I was listening to episodes last night, and it's like, who's the guy that does like, who's like the announcer on Jeopardy? That guy's like the best.
Oh, I watch that show every night.
I know, and that guy, he is the like, he's the man.
I agree. I've listened to it so far, I was like, oh man, Allie really knows like. Broadcast should have been your thing.
I went to Tosca the other night, and some of the servers.
You really encapsulate things with your intro, and you go to Tosca.
Yeah, I go to Tosca a lot. So I was at Tosca, and some of the servers were like, "Your voice on the show." I was like, "Oh, I never knew I had this little talent."
Yeah,
I like that.
Well, Pablo.
Oh yeah, we got to talk about we're so excited for this guest. We've talked about him a lot. He's my mentor, one of my favorite people in the entire world, Pablo Rojas.
Hello.
Director of Operations for Improv Asylum, Laugh Boston, Asylum New York City, and you own your own theater company.
Yeah.
You do?
Ministry of Theater.
Yeah, Ministry of Theater.
Oh, shit.
It's a side production company I have just to like produce commercial theater, and then that is the parent company of my Catalyst Comedy brand, which produces Dirty Disney and a bunch of other shows.
Dirty Disney, you can catch at Laugh Boston.
Yeah, it's Laugh Boston's longest running show.
I love that.
Yeah. See, I didn't know these. Well, this is good.
Yeah.
I don't really know much.
Well, as you've, I heard your first episodes and everything, and like you said, there's tons and tons of stories on Pablo.
I know. Well, you're like a reoccurring character.
Yeah.
So have you listened? I was going to ask you this while we were just shooting the shit. So have you?
Yeah, I have listened. I listened to the first episode, and I was going through the second one just recently. Yeah.
Well, we have been tickled, Allie and I, because this is sort of my world, and we don't, Pablo and I don't really know each other. We know each other a little bit from through Allie.
Yeah, passing ships.
Yeah, and obviously being involved in the parent company here, which we love, which is so fun and is really a lot of fun stuff that we've been doing. But the I forget what I was talking about.
How excited you are that Pablo's on the show. I got you.
Totally lost.
You were talking about how you almost feel like you know Pablo through my stories, but you haven't actually spent time and talked to Pablo.
Oh God, it makes me so nervous. Just stories and stories.
When we were at Tosca together, I would do expo a lot, and I'd be up at the pass doing expo with Kevin, and I'd be telling him stories, and he'd be like, "Where'd you learn that? How do you know about that?" I'm like, "Oh, it's got Pablo.
Every story
had you in it." So even though we didn't see each other for like 8 years, you've always been a constant figure in my life. So this is
incredible.
That's so sweet. I love it.
So what I was thinking about saying was that we've been so happy to kind of do this and that it's grown into whatever it is right now.
Yeah,
we have a little following, and we're just so happy because people have really enjoyed it. So
awesome.
So to actually create something and to do something that people are into and enjoy has really, really been fun. And it's a little sort of like motivation to like
do better. Yeah, you and I have talked about this a lot off air, that we're like, oh, people are listening. We got to get better ideas and more hosts.
Yeah, now you have an obligation.
Yeah, we're getting excited. We'll be texting each other at like midnight, like, oh, here's an idea. And he'll reach out to colleagues, and then they'll text me and be like, yeah, set it up. So we're having a blast.
That's
I'm meeting incredible people in the industry.
I mean, it's a testament to the process too, right?
Like, yeah.
Sometimes you just got to start it, play around, have fun, and then you start, you know, developing, and you start figuring out what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. But I'm excited because, you know, Pablo has been in the industry for what? 25, 30 years? How long?
Yeah, I would say. So I'm 29, 30 years in theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Theater and nightclubs and restaurants.
Yeah, I would say 29 years.
You don't look that old.
No.
I know, he looks so good. It's not fair.
You look thin too, huh? You losing weight?
I'm not eating.
No, cool.
They got me working so much right now.
This whole episode is just a love fest on Pablo. I love it.
I think I've been in the industry for 29, 30 years, and I also count like high school years, because when we in my school we did like productions that were intense, and we had summer consortiums that were like massive productions. We brought in like choreographers from New York and Broadway and stuff like that, so we did those kind of things. So I learned a lot through my high school years, but I think I've been in nightclubs and hospitality since 2005, So what is that now? That's 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or no. Yeah. About 20.
Almost
21 years.
Yeah.
That is one thing that has come up a couple times in here too. Is like to do it again. Your high school productions, like. I think that there's too many people like me, like when I was growing up, right? You didn't want to be like a theater kid because it wasn't macho and it wasn't cool and stuff. But in
back
retrospect.
Back in like the 80s and 90s and stuff?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my school was so different. My school was very different.
You went to like a musical theater school, right?
No.
Oh,
no,
you
no,
didn't?
No, no, no. Oh. We just, it was a suburban school just outside of Philadelphia and the place just had money. So.
But in retrospect, like I wish I was not. Maybe it's just speaking towards me. Like, I wasn't cool. I wasn't.
You wish you were more empowered to do that.
Because people were down on that sort of stuff. And I wish that I did expose myself to it. Because it's so cool. And to see, especially what you guys do. And I just feel like I'm just saying that. I'm not really describing
it. So, another really interesting thing about Pablo, I'm really going to sell you today.
Okay, awesome.
Another really interesting thing about Pablo is that he created his own major track at Boston University.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, I guess I can talk about that.
Yeah,
so,
let's,
yeah, when
let's
I went
get
to,
into it.
When
I
went
even
to,
know what that means, so it sounds very cool to me.
It's awesome. Listen to this.
I went to BU. So I auditioned to get into the school, and I got into the acting program. So my goal was to be an actor when I first started out and everything. So it was like traditional, like Shakespeare, and traditional kind of works and things like that. And my audition piece was actually a Shakespearean piece. And when I got into it, after my first year, I was kind of enamored with all of these other aspects of the production, because we always had, in high school, it was like there were the actors, then there was like the production team, and everyone kind of was very isolated. So I was always an actor, and I had a lot of lead roles in my shows. I was like the dentist in Little Shop of Horrors. I was the stage manager in Our Town. Like, so these were like all like big roles. And what ended up happening was after my first year in college, I was like, we did this one production of Einstein's Dreams by Alan Lightman, who was a professor over at MIT. And he just written this book, gorgeous, very ephemeral type of work that I think since has had more actual professional productions, but we did an ensemble piece. And I ended up loving the creative, collaborative aspects of it more than performing in it and working with everybody. So when it came down to, and I was in a conservatory program, so they cut people every year. They basically say, you're not good enough when it comes down to it.
You
lose your spot, even after paying them all this money. I don't know if they're still conservatory, but I think at the time it was. And so at the end, they do these interviews with you to say, like, where do you feel where's your growth in this, or whether they're going to continue with you or not. They said they were interested in continuing with me, but I told them I wanted to, I think I wanted to be a producer, but I didn't know really what that meant. So... They offered to say, well, let's put you in our theater studies program, which is half of our program's acting, half of it's theater studies, both of them conservatory. And then they basically gave me a carte blanche to go to any school within the university to get the most diverse education I wanted. So I was able to go to School of Communication without taking any of the prerequisites. So I was able to take a lot of their top tier, like senior level producing courses. I took high level like English and creative writing courses at CAS, College of Arts and Sciences. And yeah, I kind of created my own track because they don't have a producing track or anything like that. So they offered me the flexibility to kind of pursue my interests within the context of producing theater and being like more commercial theater. And
I just love this story. I love the fact that he was like, you know what? I still want to be in this world. How do I kind of navigate around the business part of this world?
Yeah. I find it so fascinating, but it's like horribly over my head.
No, I love that story too. And then I just want to give some people some backstory of how Pablo and I first met, because I love this too. So I was working at Improv Asylum as one of the front of house managers, and we were kind of going through general managers pretty quickly because they just weren't great fits for the company. And finally, ownership had come to all the managers and said, all right, guys, we're going to include you in the process of hiring the new GM, because you ultimately have to work with them, you have to get along with them, and you have to respect them. And the problem was we had a bunch of people in that we just did not respect, could not control us, like we just didn't want to work for.
We just did not respect.
We had no respect for them. Like even I was 19 years old, and I knew, like, okay, I'm not going to do what you say. I have no respect for you. So... They brought in four candidates, and me and the other three managers at the time sat with all the candidates and interviewed them and asked them questions. And unanimously across the board, all four of us picked Pablo. Like, there was not even a discussion about it. We voted everybody else
off the island.
Yeah, we voted everyone off. Like, I remember it was like me, Trevor, Victor, and Brian, and we're all sitting there talking. And Pablo had asked for like a tour of the theater, which no one else had asked for. So we gave him a nice little tour of the theater. He was asking us questions, which nobody else had asked. And to this day, he had sent in handwritten thank you cards to each one of us. And we compared them, and they were each personalized. Mine was, I still have it. Mine says...
You guys compared them?
Yeah. Because we wanted to see if they were generic, because we were a little shithead at 19-year-olds that were like, is this guy for real? Or, and my note said, thank you so much for the tour. I appreciated you showing me the theater. Loved getting to meet you guys. Hope I get the ability to work with you. I still have that note. I loved it. To this day...
I got my big cry.
After every interview, I now do a handwritten note because that was so impactful to me. I did a handwritten note when I got the job at Tosca. And the general manager over there... was like, this is a handwritten note? Like, even he was like, that is kind of a dying art. And I was like, yeah, it was so impactful to me that I do it every single time.
Awesome.
So that was how I met Pablo. So I like to tease him and say that I hired him, even though he was my boss. I like to tease him.
I know who to blame for the last 16 years.
Yeah, it's my fault that you've been here for so long. But no, Pablo also has a very interesting connection to our podcast because he has worked at some major fine dining restaurants. He's worked at nightclubs. He's produced events. He's managed events, the operations of events. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to someone, you know, we've talked about this before, that the podcast should be a little educational for people. So I said to Pablo before we came on, I said, maybe we could talk about what are things that people should know when they're booking an event. What are things that people should think about that they just don't think about so that this can be a little educational. Mm.
You love the educational aspect. Yeah. You're always talking about it. You're always sort of toeing the line.
Yeah, I love it. I just sort of go. I like to like joke around and like shoot the shit with you, but I also like to make sure that we're staying on some kind of theme or...
Well, I think it's also important because more and more as we get through this business, it feels like... Sometimes clients, and it's not to be disparaging, but sometimes they just have unrealistic expectations, or particularly when it comes to theater. Like, so we balance that line between nightclub and theater, but there's still like it's a performance, and it's, you know, there's this theatrical element. And there seems to be a lack of that kind of decorum or understanding of how to behave in a performance.
Yeah,
it's not a concert. It's not where people are screaming and loud. Like, you're listening to someone deliver something that is either practiced or improvised, but that even in that improvisation, it is a skill set that they have routinely practiced and worked with other people, and they're trying to deliver that to a large group of individuals, and that delivery is critical.
Yeah,
and people just think like they can scream and shout and interrupt other people.
It's interesting that you think about that, because like I was thinking about this the other night, and so Allie and I separately went to
just to make sure we didn't drive together.
Not separately. No, you offered to pick me up.
I did.
No,
I did offer to pick you up.
Not separately like that. Allie was invited to an event that she was officially invited. I think I invited myself. For a release party for a TV show that one of our mutual friends was doing. She came like a civilized human and brought a date and had fun and enjoyed herself. And I was like, fuck that. I am not going to this thing and sitting there like a jackass. So I made food.
Yeah,
so
he worked it. He like wanted to be a part of it, but he didn't want to be a guest at it. So he worked it so that he could be there.
I get that feeling.
It's like a parallel there. Like, I didn't want to be that guy just sitting there enjoying myself. This is what I do to myself. I was like, if I'm going, I'm going to make some food. Be useful. That's like my
Kenny
thought.
And I were like, we're just going for the free food and the friendship. Like, we're going to like support.
Too. Yeah, but
enjoy a good night.
It's interesting to hear you talk about how to act, because like I don't always know how to act.
Well,
hide behind food.
Yeah, but that's fine. I mean, because that, you know, that's the environment you feel most comfortable in. But if you were going to like go see a show that you're paying money to go see, a lot of people think like, well, I paid money to see this. I'm like, yes, but there's 199 other people who did the same thing. And so what your own individual behavior doesn't dictate how everyone else's experience is, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I'm always amazed. Like, I think that there should be there's an unwritten rule of decorum when you go to a show, a movie theater. You don't talk, you don't disrupt it. Like, you sit in silence and you enjoy what you paid for. And a lot of people, they don't give that same respect to comedy. And they don't give the same respect to smaller produced shows. They're always like, ah, it's 100 people. Who cares? No, if it's four people, it's still the proper decorum to sit and let everyone enjoy it at their own pace and let everyone enjoy the show peacefully.
Yeah. And so, and it's not to say that you like you can't be like loud and have fun.
Yeah, we're not saying don't laugh. We want to laugh.
And everyone takes it that way. They're like, yeah. Oh, you're not, I'm not allowed to laugh or I'm not allowed to be myself. I'm like, no, you can. But, you know, having full-on conversations or just, get on your phone,
you know, you
or
you don't have to
like
remark
that.
After the stand-up says something. You don't have to be like, I agree with that. Like, shut up and laugh.
I think there's an element of that in dining, too. Like you get a lot of people that like you could serve them all this food and they just put it in front of them and they just eat it and they're like whatever. And then
or your favorite, the person who does not order appetizers.
No. But then there's the other person, right?
Oh, you gotta tell me more about that.
Yeah.
There's the other person that you put the food in front of and they don't even enjoy it at all. They've gotta take a picture of it. They've gotta super analyze it, they gotta dissect it and this and that. Which is like great, because you want people to be into it. You want people to be passionate.
You know what's
about
weird
it,
dining etiquette that I
enjoy it too. There's
weird dining etiquette that I noticed working in restaurants that I can't fucking stand it. Is when a customer holds on to their menu and they're like, "We're gonna order apps," and then the server's like, "Oh, what can I get you for dinner?" And they're like, "We're gonna wait like 45 minutes before we even tell you what we want for dinner." I'm like, "There's no need to do that. You can order."
Wait, they literally say, "I'm going to wait for 45 minutes.
No, but so people at the restaurant, they would order their appetizers. And then when the server would like give them a minute or go get drinks, they'd come back and the server would say, "Can I take your dinner order?" And they go, "We're not ready to order dinner yet." And I would be on the server as the manager being like, "We need that table at this time. Get the menu order or get the dinner order." And they'd come back to me and say they refuse to give me the dinner order. This is the craziest mindset.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's the weirdest mindset to me, and it happens all the time.
Like, I can understand if you're like, "Oh, let me get an appetizer, but when you come back, I'll have like my entree ready to go." Because I'm still looking, or I'm still undecided. Like I'm.
Well, the one that really kills you is like the person that does that, and then then when they do order, they expect their food.
Yeah, and then they're like, "I ordered this 10 minutes ago. Where is it?" We're like, "You should have ordered it earlier." So, if anyone listening to this, please put your dinner order in at the same time you put your app order in, or at least, but like, put in your apps, get your drink, and put it in right afterwards. Please do not wait 30 to 45 minutes to be like, "Now we're ready." It's crazy.
Some places
that's a weird
food very quickly, though. Eh.
I guess McDonald's, yeah. But like, if you're going...
No, but if you're going to a restaurant, I mean, like, if I want food really fast and I'm going to a restaurant or I want that kind of level of service, I sit at the bar because that's a captive server. Like, the bartender is a captive server. So I'm like, I'm there. But if I'm like, if I'm sitting at a table, then I'm going to be like, it's going to take a little bit longer. And that's part of the experience. I'm there to have a conversation or enjoy my time with the person I'm with.
Yeah.
But a good server should know how long something takes. A good server should be able to gauge that experience and know what the capabilities of the kitchen are. I've had this experience have I ever told the food too fast story?
No.
So I've had people that, I'm trying to word this the right way. I've had people that I work with say, "Oh, the food comes out too fast." And I've like literally had to think about it, right? Because like I can formulate thoughts, but I'm not the biggest thinker in the world. I was like, I don't want to hear the food comes out too fast ever again.
Yeah,
I was like, because that is the greatest.
Is that because they're firing it too soon?
Yeah, they're not coordinating.
The servers are not firing it correctly.
If I could make the food fast and of the proper quality, that is the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
So it comes into a matter of timing. And it's a matter of timing on the server's end. Because
the server should know how long each menu item takes and when they fire it, how long to the pass. They should absolutely know.
You know, it's
funny.
Whenever I go to a restaurant, I usually say, the food can come out whenever it's ready. I'm not a person.
You worked in restaurants, and
I'm
you
always
understand.
Like, I want it, because there have been times where they're like, "I'll eat that," and it may come out too fast. They fired it too soon, and then I like the plate comes out, and the plate is like gonna burn my skin because it's been sitting under the heat lamp. I'm like, give it to me as the chef intended. It's ready to go. Just bring it over.
That will screw up some server stuff.
You ever have the server that blames the kitchen, and they're like, "I'm so sorry, the kitchen fired this too fast," and you're like, "No, they fucking didn't." They're not back there pushing buttons and calling tickets. They did not fire this too fast. That's like every server's go-to excuse. It's like, "I'm so sorry, the kitchen fired this and picked it up too early. Do you mind if I bring it out?" I'm like, don't lie to me. Just tell me you picked it up too early and I'll be fine with it.
So I want to ask Pablo, right? This is totally like self-serving here for the podcast.
Isn't that what the whole podcast is?
No. But I just want to just jump in with something else before you tell more like flattering Pablo stories, because I know
I would love for this to be an hour of flattery, because man,
no, I'm telling you, morning. We'll let her rip. She can get it up to like 3 hours.
Oh, I love it.
And I have to somebody bring pizza in or something. So, but we were talking. Ellie and I were talking about this the other day, and I want to get your thoughts. So now we're recording, right? And you're like going to be, you know, we've had a bunch of guests, and you're going to be like our episode 16 or
like
something?
17.
Oh, really?
I'm starting to lose count.
Well, you guys are my first, just so you know.
So,
is this your first time on a podcast?
I have never done a podcast.
Oh,
this
I
is
love
my
this.
Absolute first time anything of this nature. I've been wanting to do it for some time, right. But I never feel like I have anything to say, so.
Ooh,
yeah,
we're going to have a permanent re-guest spot for Pablo.
I know, I was thinking about that yesterday.
Yeah, he's going to be our permanent guest, you know,
yeah,
repeat.
Give me a special segment where
what's,
you guys could just
what's
pull me
the
in.
Word? A recurring character. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah, recurring character.
You're going to be a
recurring
character.
I think
we got to
do recurring character with Mike Morway.
Oh, yeah.
He was so good. I listened to that. So anyways, so there's this weird gap of when these things are released, right? So yeah. I'm talking, I don't know. So, but when we get there, Allie was telling me yesterday, like our most popular episode so far, right? Because we only have 6 released.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like 10-ish behind when you listen. I don't know. It's all fucked up. Blow my mind. It's like we're timed.
Or it's going in order, just as it was intended.
Yeah, it's going in order. But
he's
it's
just not used to that we've recorded this months ago.
I don't know. It's over my head. So, but what do you think about, Allie was telling me, our most popular episode, most listened to episode. Which one was it?
What not to do when hosting an event. It's by far the most listened to episode, which I find so interesting.
How much?
Was that the second one? I was going to say that's the second one.
That's the second one.
I remember you guys immediately going into trust the event planner, which is you're paying us to do a job. Let us do it.
Yeah.
What do you think? Right, as somebody this you're new to the podcast, but what do you think? Why would you think that's popular?
The what not to do.
Or capture lightning in a bottle here.
Well, I'd be curious to know who's listening, right? Because if it's cathartic for event planners who are listening to this and we're like, yep, that was wrong. Like the people shouldn't be doing that kind of stuff. Or if there's actually people who are like, I want to be educated. Like what should I not be doing? Is it like the top 10 list of something you see on Medium or something like that?
That's what my thinking is. Like, you know how everyone loves their top 10 product reviews and whatever? I wonder if there are customers out there listening being like, ooh, have I made any of these faux pas? Have I done any of these?
Well, what are your whatnot?
I think everyone just loves negative, and that was a negative episode. And everyone
But Pablo deals with a lot of this stuff, so let's do a little look back.
I'm actually in the middle of that episode, so I was listening to you guys give some of your stories. But I think the top things, if someone's like, "What are the top things not to do?" It's once an agreement is set, don't start changing the terms or starting to ask for these extras, you know.
Oh, you mean what just happened here today?
Yeah. You can't just sell somebody out with this story, though. Don't blurt it out.
It's going to come out in 3 months. Nobody knows the date I'm talking about.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God. You're gonna be like, Ari, can you edit that out? I pissed off our customers.
Nah, we're not saying names.
But,
fuck them.
Yeah, it's like be very clear about your expectations, and I think that goes into having a better understanding. If you don't know what you want in an event, then that's okay and say that, because I hope I can stay on track here. But I feel like a lot of people, particularly who they come to a place with this expectation, and they need to explain their expectation more and not what they are looking for specifically. Because often the delivery of that expectation doesn't match the specifics, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
the if you can give the event planner an overview of this is what I'm kind of picturing, but then step back and listen to their suggestions. Like, we had an event a couple months ago where they really wanted a satellite bar in the theater, and we could not convince them that it was not going to help their event. We were like, listen, a satellite bar, we have to bring product from the bar, which means you get no draft beers, you get no mixed cocktails. The most we can do over there is beer and wine, but you're not a large enough group for it to back up the bar. So their concern was that there were so many people that the bar lines would be really long.
So did you do it?
I did it, but I
did you offer them past drinks?
Oh, no, they do that automatically over there. But they wanted the satellite bar because they thought it would alleviate the bar lines. And I was trying to tell them it's not going to make a difference. And I kid you not, by the end of the event, that satellite bar had rung less than $150, meaning no one walked over there.
Yeah.
No one used it. And then
$150, that's like 10 to 15 drinks.
Yeah. So we checked it over there. I think it was 162. Yeah, this is at Laugh. So they wanted a bar, you know, the showroom where the stage is? They wanted a bar up against the Skyline windows on the other side of the room because they thought it would help with the flow. And I was trying to explain to them, like, you're 100 people. This venue is built for 300. And on any given Friday or Saturday, we see over 1,000 customers. We know how to execute for up to 300 people at a time. You're at 100 people. You're fine. I couldn't like get this through the customer's head that they did not need this. So I did it because that's my job. I have to still accommodate
you. Did you figure out how to make money on?
No, well, but
that's
this,
your bad.
But
you
this year, they booked the event again, and I brought that up. I was like, guys, just to let you know, this is what the bar rang. It was not a hit. And they agreed with me. They were like, you know what? You're right. We had no problems with the
you
bar
line.
You
should have done a signature pass cocktail. Or
they did do a signature cocktail.
Yeah. Passed or no?
Both.
See, I got all the answers.
Yeah, we did all of that. Like, we executed it correctly. It was just like I couldn't tell her, you know. Yeah,
because they had a very specific vision in their mind. Yeah.
So if you have a vision, that's fine. But if you're working, like I said before, if you're working with a venue manager who knows that venue inside and out, trust them. Trust them a little bit. You're paying them money because
the flow.
Yeah,
that's a big thing.
You could have rented out a VFW and done it yourself.
Oh
you
my God,
didn't.
You're hammering on VFWs again.
I heard that on the.
If you want to go that route and do it all on your own, you might as well save the money and do that.
Yeah.
But if you're going to book a private event manager. If you're
going
to book a private event planner and pay the extra money for it, listen to them.
Yeah.
And I can understand if there's like a small item that they're like, this would really make my day. Like, I think you had your scallop story and stuff like that. So like that's an important thing to take note of. But I think overall it's people need to come in with this idea of like, what is the feeling I want to leave with? That this was taken care of, people had a great time, it was an amazing experience, people are shaking my hand, I'm the hero, whatever it might be. And then let us help you achieve that. Obviously, they might have, if it's a corporate event, they might have a boss who's like, "Well, I really need to have this and that for like their presentations and whatnot." But usually, if it's just like a big party or something, like, do you want everyone leaving and then saying, "Oh my God, this was the best thing ever. Let's do it again." You know what I mean? Like,
we will
make that happen. Just let us do that. So just tell us how you want to leave. How you want to leave feeling, and then like we'll help make that
absolutely
happen.
Yeah. I love putting it that way. I love that so much.
That's because remember when you first started here again, like we were talking about like a lot of people will start telling us exactly what they want for like tech or this or that, and there's like all the intricate ways. And I'm like, what? I just always say, what are you looking to achieve? Great. This is how I recommend achieving that, because there's always more than one path to get to the end result. Everyone thinks differently, and I totally get that, but we know this place and everything. So it's like, what are you looking to achieve? And when they start having that, like they start expressing that, that's when we can start honing in on, great, this is what I can do for you to achieve that. If we do it this way, this is what's going to happen potentially with our system, or this is what it's going to cost you extra. So this helps you save some money too if we do it this way. And, you know, and it saves you money because we're doing less work and less labor, but we get the same result.
Yeah. I always love... when I first started here, going to Pablo constantly for like trying to learn all the fire egresses, learning what they could hang stuff up on, what they couldn't hang. Like, we have so much technical equipment on the ceiling at the theater, and people like want to hang balloons or they want to hang streamers. So just learning about what people can and can't do in the space, that's huge. That you must have dealt with that a lot before I got here.
Yeah.
It was like all you before I got here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You getting a new mic?
You need help with that tool.
You don't even understand. Sometimes he brings a screwdriver with him, and he's like adjusting the microphones.
He's pulling pliers out from the middle of the table. What's going on?
What is happening?
So tell us. So Pablo.
Every time he's
as
like,
he fixes his microphone
every
with pliers,
time.
I know, but it's I don't know. It's gone limp. So tell us about. I'm curious because I know that you've spent a lot of time traveling for work lately, so I'm curious to
the nice satisfying
where you've been, what you've been doing, how you
like
traveling.
New York. Talk about New York.
Oh, God.
I've done some stuff where I've opened some restaurants and different properties like out of the state, and I've spent a lot of time doing it a bunch of different times, like, you know, far enough away where I couldn't commute. So give me some of your I don't know, anecdotal stories.
And well, there's stories or no one knows what I'm doing, so you got to prompt me for some stories. But I mean, what I can say for right now is, yeah, I have been traveling a lot. I've been basically most weeks kind of just been in New York City, so kind of like half living there and back and forth. But yeah, we just opened up Asylum NYC. I affectionately call it 2.0 because we used to have a space in Chelsea. We lost that when the landlord sold the building for development. And then we moved ourselves over to this new location, which we took over from a previous comedy theater that, man, it was a rundown. It was a rundown space. And what I constantly comment on is being communist red. It was just, just covered in red.
So what was it? What was the space before that?
It was the space was the, it was called the Pit, which is known as the People's Improv Theater. They have history in New York, and they've
been around for a while.
They've been around for a while, and they do good stuff. Just not what we do. So when we took over that space, we decided to really go in the direction of how do we elevate our artistry? How do we elevate our craft for the audiences? Because we're a company that, and I agree with this fully because this is why I've been here for so long, is we would like to produce shows for the people, right? So not just for like ourselves or for audio, like, you know, other improvisers or artists. We'd like to produce shows that are really out there for the audiences and they're experiential. So, but part of that, what was interesting about this particular space, which is new to us, was we always had these basement theater spaces, and we were really good. We were like hermit crabs. We can find a space, and we can like take those bones, and we can make it into something like really amazing. But we always get basement spaces because, you know, we're a theater. We don't need windows really and anything like that. But this particular space was really intriguing because they had full on street a frontage. And so we had huge windows leading into a bar, and they had an awning that looked, to be honest, looked like the entrance to a strip club because there was just plaster with all sorts of things on there. So we've been classing the place up a bit. We were like really trying to elevate what people view as a comedy club and a comedy theater. So when you first walk in, it's got a very for the lack of a better word, like an old boys club type of feel. It's a lot of brown, like wood, dark
gold. There's gold, a lot of gold
dark lighting,
trims,
yeah, and things like that.
The pictures look so, I haven't been out there yet, but the pictures look so incredible. It looks like you've been transported back in time to old school New York.
Yeah.
It looks so cool, Kevin. Yeah, I can't wait.
But with like a nod to like some comedic influences. So like behind the bar, we have this gorgeous purple wallpaper with like bamboo shoots and things like that. But it's there's monkeys hanging off all the bamboo shoots that are each like drinking bottles of like vodka or smoking cigarettes and
cigars.
Very
whimsical.
Yeah, whimsical. That's the best way to describe it. We wanted to be sincere, elegant, but with a bit of whimsy. So, and then even like the rest of the wallpaper and the rest of the space, it's like if you look at it and it's like this gorgeous pattern, but when you get close to it, it's all like little martini glasses with like little things splashing, but it's all in a perfect pattern. So it just has this elegant type of a look and feel.
So it's kind of like a Monet, like from far away, it's very fancy, but from up close, it's very whimsy. I love that.
Yeah, yeah, that's I like that.
Yeah, I really love that. And we're going to be doing private events out of there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you like being out of town?
I do, because it's a fulfillment of a dream that I had as a kid. It's like, you know, I'm working in the theater. I think everyone's like, oh, you want to go to New York. I actually opted to stay in Boston because a lot of my colleagues went to New York and they were living in just abject poverty.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
Just like, they're like, oh, I'm a working artist. And, you know,
$3,100 for 400 square foot? Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, that's not the lifestyle I want right after college. I know I'm going to struggle a little bit and try to make my name and make things work well, but I still have to, you know, I didn't want to be that much. And the spaces that I saw, particularly back then, because Brooklyn, I think Williamsburg at the time was not the place that it is now. So basically making a career from Boston, which is kind of an off, you know, a regional theater area, not like, you know, it's a major market, but not necessarily one for theater or performance that people view. And then being able to be a part of a company that is contributing to a new, hopefully a lasting legacy of comedy and theater in New York and being a partner and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of people have asked me about the move to New York. They're like, I've had people say, do you think it'll do well because there's so much famous comedy in New York? And I'm like, yeah, I think it's such a great comedy town. that it will do well because there's so many comedians in that town looking for a space. There's so many shows looking to be produced in New York City that don't have homes. So yeah, I think anytime you open up a theater in New York City, it's going to do well. I don't think there's an oversaturation in that market. I think there's so much theater in that market that it's fine.
Yeah, and particularly for this space, you know, we're able to, we're currently working on phase two, which is the opening of a second performance space, which is really amazing because this will be one of the first times we'll have like two solid performance spaces in one venue.
Yeah.
But to continue on with the idea of the development of that place, we, you know, we worked with an outside designer to help us execute some of our ideas. And we were able to, you know, we had that beautiful bar. And then when you open these golden doors, like very art, like this, like, looks elaborate looking Art Deco doors, you walk back into what appears to be like a New York City mashup alley of like Chinatown, old world.
Oh yeah, it looks like outdoor street inside.
Yeah.
It looks like you're walking down like a cobblestone street, but you're inside the building.
Yeah, and that was inspired by like from shows that we have seen like Sleep No More, where you can walk around and you can interact with the space and you feel like you're going into a shop and you can look at different things. So we created this alleyway that allowed us to kind of mimic that to a degree. It's still a hallway that leads to the restrooms and to the theater, but when you first walk in, you're like, you feel like you're transported and it's a whole new portal into something new.
I love it. I want to see it.
Yeah. And everything, and that was that, and that is really one of the big things that I started to focus on, because when we started doing the space, we're like, oh, we had all these crazy ideas. And I was like, well, now we have to look at it as every door you open, like literally every door you open transports you to something brand new. So we have each restroom wildly different. And like literally we have three restrooms on that main hallway and every single one is completely different than the last. You walk into the cast only areas, vastly different experience and lighting and feel, and then you walk up to these like VIP stairs that have a different carpeting. It's a very eclectic mix of stuff, and then up into what we call our Lenny Bruce room, which is like a VIP room that it's also like basically you're being transported into 1950s, you know, smoking room type of thing. So it's really nice. And then I can't wait for the phase two. Phase two is one.
So you're so involved in all this stuff and conceptualizing it and executing it and every level of it. So tell me about. It seems like, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think I'm right, you guys have purchased and reuse existing comedy spaces. Like, is that part of the plan?
I think, yeah. So in the past, we've taken, so, you know, we have this location in Louisville that we had opened, and that was a pre-existing comedy space that we kind of refreshed. That was a quick and easy thing. I know the Improv Asylum back in the day, I think, used to be called Nonsense. It was many years before me. And then even before that, I think it was another performance space.
And before that, a bowling alley.
Yeah, before that, a bowling alley, right?
So was that part of the formula of like what you guys are doing?
It's certainly helpful because right. So Laugh Boston, I think, was one of the first places we went into, because so I started working for Improv Asylum, and then when we opened up Laugh Boston a few years later, that was one of the first places that was literally raw space.
Yep.
It was cement, pillars, everything. There was nothing in there.
Yeah,
and this was
fully
years
designed that.
Fully designed, yeah. And that was many years before what the Seaport was or is now, right? That was, I would say, probably a pretty huge gamble because we're like, oh, this is a really good space.
Oh, yeah, that was back when the Seaport was still a parking lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were no buildings. I mean, I think there was, like, I forgot what it was called, but it was like near the Atlantic, it was an Atlantic Bar and Pub or something. It was like something that looked like it was going to fall into the ocean.
a lot of times, like if you take over an existing restaurant space, especially if it's been there for a lot of years, you've got to break ties with the old one.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
And like, totally reform it.
Yeah, like, oh, and I used to come here. That's the biggest like regret with people when they take over a thing. It's like they either have to kind of toe along some of the old, or they have to completely break from it. So what's interesting is, I guess trying to boil down the logic behind it to me is, you're going to take over a comedy space, like especially as I get older, I think like, oh yeah, I went to this comedy show and it was here. And then like, if you're not like a big comedy person, you're like, oh, I don't give a fuck. I don't care who owns it or whatever. It's like, I went to this spot and it's here. Let's see if it's still there. And you kind of like look it up.
Yeah.
So you have like that recognition of location, I guess, right? Is that what I'm trying to say? I don't know. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, with some restaurants, that could be a good thing or a bad thing, right? Because there's that old adage of like if some, you know, some restaurants like live and die at a certain location repeatedly and yeah. like they can never get out of that and it's always being used. But I don't know, we haven't experienced that. We've taken over, you know, through our expansion. Like I think La Boston was our first major expansion, and that was a brand new facility, and it was big, it's beautiful, and it's been running for over 10 years now. Mm-hmm. Then we did New York. That was our first sort of like moving into another space that was there
outside the city. That was the first like
outside
of
Boston,
Boston,
right?
Yeah.
That's New York City, obviously, yeah. And then we took over a historic space from another group called UCB.
Oh, yeah. Very historic comedy space.
And
yeah.
there's a lot of people in the community. And I think what's nice is that you're talking about like the public, right? Because there's two dynamics for us in theaters. There's the public. You're like, oh, yeah, I used to see shows at this location. One of them still doing shows. That's awesome. And then there's the community, right? And then if you're in the improv community, I don't know how to say this. It's can be cutthroat.
competitive.
Yeah. But people love what they love, right? So
I think that's just acting in general.
Yeah.
Is
it's
so
all it's most of the arts and
yeah,
most of the arts
all the arts are so competitive.
But in this particular sense, there's people who used to be like part of the UCB community. You're like, oh, you, how dare you take over that space that belongs to UCB? I'm like, well, you know, UCB up and left. There's a reason, because they opened up another space because they're a business. They found a space that they thought was better. They moved into that and they're doing their thing somewhere
else.
Yeah,
like people thought you like kicked them out. Yeah. Like, we didn't kick
and,
them
like,
out.
We didn't do anything. We're not taking over something. Like UCB does what UCB does.
Yeah,
and
they
we
left
do what
and
we
said, we'll take it. Like that's totally different from like taking over UCB's spot.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be one thing if we were calling ourselves UCB.
Yeah, that would be fucked up.
And then try to do what they do, but
trying
like,
to like piggyback off of there.
The extent of what we like as we do as a company or anything is like improv is a foundation for what we do, and sketch and comedy, like, and that's kind of universal for a lot of these spaces. But how we produce our shows, who we produce our shows with, and how we present them, immensely different. So yeah,
I'm always impressed by this company's growth because I. As we've talked about before, I worked here 12 years ago, and it was just one venue in Boston. That's it. That's all it was. When I came back to this company, I still had it in my head that it was going to be a small production, and they all of a sudden, they like added all these venues. There's way more people that work here. It was so compelling for me to come back and be like, wow, look at the growth that this company
has had.
Yeah.
It does. He loves the magazine.
I love the magazine. I never saw the magazine.
Yeah, he loves
today.
It. So I was like so impressed by the growth of this company that now it is a real player on the stage of improv. Well, I'm saying like for so long, improv had a very small market. You had UCB, you had the pit, you had Second City, and you have the Groundlings out in LA.
And IO in Chicago.
Yeah. So it was a very small community. And for a long time, IA was just Boston.
I don't know NIO.
IO is, they're formerly known as Improv Olympic, and then they got sued by the Olympics Committee or something. So they had just reduced their name to IO.
Oh.
Yeah.
So I always, you know, in college when I was just a front of house manager, Improv Asylum was big in Boston, but it was not big outside of Boston. Now, when we travel, it is a known name, which is very impressive to me.
That's cool to know because I sometimes don't see or feel that, but yeah. It's good to hear that. Yeah.
And it's funny because now that we've been here almost 30 years, our alumni are starting to get a lot of notoriety, right? Yeah. So we have alumni on television, on movies, in radio, in all kinds of aspects. We have an alumnist who writes for SNL. Like, our alumni are doing big things, which is getting us recognized. Like, everyone thinks of Second City as producing, like, all these big comedians and SNL cast. I love that we are now in that conversation. I love that Improv Asylum is now producing alumni and comedians and people in this theater community. And we're becoming a real player on the stage of improv.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of us for doing this.
Actually, I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I think at least right after. Yeah. Well, that's what the podcast is for. We just make up facts.
We don't reference shit.
But I actually.
What's the word? Truthiness.
I do think that after the pandemic, just by default, with like a lot of the closures and everything, we became the second largest comedy company, production company, and theater company in the United States after the Second City.
Yeah, we survived from doing corporate shows, virtual shows, trainings, and just putting out a good product. So I'm proud of us for surviving.
Yeah,
I'm proud of us for being now in the conversation with very recognizable, great comedy company.
It seems like the pandemic, business-wise, people that survived, like it favored the bold. You guys really did.
I know that at least that the owner here, Norm Laviolette, he, like, to his testament, tried a lot of different things and experimented a lot with stuff because that was the time to do it.
You guys
right?
tried with like a restaurant, right? At the patio?
You
guys tried
so many things.
I was following it through the pandemic.
Yeah. We did a restaurant.
They did so much to try to stay relevant.
Yeah, and like, but even during the pandemic, trying to at least just stay relevant and in be a, like have people give us a sense of awareness of who we were. Like we were doing online shows, and like that was a terrible thing. But you know, they all the
yeah,
people
comedy is best live.
Yeah, always.
Always.
That's why I stick in it.
Heard Norm say, "I don't ever want to do that again."
Yeah.
Right. I wasn't as involved in that, but I was on like in the shadows, ready to support and do whatever was necessary. As things started to get back up and running, and that kind of stuff is it's heavy. It's really, and you know, you don't get the sign of feedback. Live entertainment is absolutely critical.
Oh,
it's essential.
God.
It's essential.
It's what I missed the most during the lockdown. It was live performances and live entertainment. You know how much I love Broadway.
And I like. I
actually,
love
you
TV.
Both know how much I love Broadway.
Like
this
I love
guy
TV.
Might love it just as much.
Yeah, I love TV. I love film and all those kind of things. But you don't get the same experience you get from a live performance. And in Broadway. Yeah. Like just being in a room where everyone's getting that collective energy and like laugh or sadness or those ebb and flow of emotions from a performance is just epic. For someone like myself who doesn't like, I'm a little bit like you, and I would like to work an event but not be a part of an event. You know, like I like the chaos or I like being involved but not really participating. For something like that is one of my biggest sense of it's the one thing that really makes me feel like I have a sense of community. If I'm sitting in an audience and this person on stage where all of our attention is focused on and they're presenting something and we're all collectively like we have a sense like, wow, these people are all laughing at the same thing because we have a sense of connection on what they're talking about. And then whether that's comedy or if it's like a story.
He's so passionate about it. He's like so into it.
I'm telling you, the two of you have way more in common than you'd even think. The way that you creatively think about things and challenge your own, you almost like challenge your own beliefs every single time you go
Pablo's
to work.
Pablo's talking about a totally different world than my...
But you approach things the same exact way.
Well, maybe.
You approach your menus, the way you design kitchens, the way that you design restaurants. You guys approach things so similarly, and I think that might be why I worked so well with both of you.
Theater gave me an appreciation for food and hospitality, because when I moved to theater, there's always that joke of like, oh, you're going to work in... Because I actually had people in my life who are like, oh, you're doing theater, you're going to just be a server or something, or, you know, and very disparaging or whatnot. And it gave me
people
a respect
love
for...
Hate.
Yeah, they love to hate. And it gave me a respect for the work because there's a craft behind it. There's a dedication that if you don't work in that industry, you will never understand or get. And whether it's the same thing in theater because you have to work really hard. And both hospitality, like restaurants and theaters particularly, are the few businesses that integrate multidisciplinary things, right? So like in theater, You have your musicians, you have your actors, you have your business people. Like you have to have all of these different, because you could be a musician and you can have a show, right? But you can't do theater or comedy or any of those kind of things without all of these elements combined. And you can't have a restaurant in the same way. You can't have it if you don't really have like good cooks doing like the food and presenting it in a certain way. People.
Bartenders, servers, all of those
aspects, managing all these different things to make this one singular experience for an individual in a certain.
Maybe that's why I was drawn to both, because I've always done theaters and restaurants as well. And I think I'm drawn to the chaos like you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm also drawn to the camaraderie that you get in this industry. You just don't. I've worked office jobs. I was never that close with my colleagues.
No.
I work in a restaurant for a year. They're my family. It's like wild, the juxtaposition between like this is my work colleague and this is like my work family.
Yeah.
It's crazy in our industry, but I think that's why we love this industry so much.
Yeah.
All right. I got to change gears here.
Okay.
Can I see your phone?
Yeah. I'm so scared. Why are you going through my phone?
I'm going to start reading text messages.
Don't swipe anything.
No, just, I'm not swiping. I'm just... No, I don't need to open it. I just wanted to see. I love it. I love this phone. We talk about Allie's phone a fair amount. Right?
Yeah.
She's got this flip. What's this called?
It's a folding phone.
The Fold Z3.
The Fold. Yeah, very creative name. It's called the Fold because it folds.
I didn't come up with the name.
So Pablo is like, you're always talking about Pablo. We got him here. This is great. It's very different perspective of things, which is actually very fascinating.
Yeah, I know. I love it.
And... Oh, I do want to talk about the length of our podcast and stuff, but that's another thing, right?
Guys, so, this is going to be like a Joe Rogan podcast, right? It's 2 hours because so, that's the time I allocated.
Yeah. So this is my
four-hour
phone, right?
Podcast.
This is an iPhone.
Phones are lighting
these,
up.
Right? So, and then Pablo, man. So
yeah.
This looks like Pablo's phone, right?
What is happening right now?
So Pablo has an iPhone. It's a little teeny baby one.
Yeah.
Is this 5 years old?
No, that's a mini. I think they just stopped making it last year, but it's a
very
13
cute.
Mini.
But I notice it's an iPhone, and he's your guy, right? We're some of your big mentors. Pablo's way more than me. I'm not trying to take away from him.
Damn.
But he's
straight.
Got. Yeah, yeah. No, you can have her. But look at, he's got an iPhone. I have an iPhone, and you have like one of these.
Yeah.
Why don't you get one of these?
You're so jealous. You love my phone.
I do like your phone. There's some benefits to it, but
Android has excellent hardware, but they don't have great software. That's the key.
I'm just saying.
That's my opinion. And I know that
I love my phone.
Let's get controversial on this podcast. Android does not do as good of a job.
I swear to God, Android users are like the most discriminated group in this entire country. It's like crazy. iPhone people hate Android people, yeah. And I will never understand it. I've had people say to me, "Oh, you don't have an iPhone because you're poor." I'm like, "My phone's $2,000. What are you talking
Pablo,
about?"
Right? If we text and it goes through and it's blue, right?
Yeah.
If I text you, it's fucking green.
First of all, this is the ultimate form of discrimination. It is literally, I've seen comics make, like, actually point this out. You're just like, it's like the most unfiltered form of discrimination ever. Like, even in some of my own casts were for like Dirty Dizzy or whatever, some of them have like iPhones and Androids, and people get super pissed off at the Android users.
Is this like the hot button issue of my time? Like, we had gay marriage, we had women's rights, and now fucking iPhone Android text.
Who gives
like
a fuck about Democrats or Republicans?
Yeah, like, is this the...
Do you have an iPhone or an Android?
I hate that this is the like argument of my lifetime.
Like, your phone has some pros, but. Why can't we just text in blue?
Why does it bother you?
Bothers me.
I know. Here's the thing. It does not bother Android users. We do not notice. Does it? I don't even know if it changes colors on me. Like, we do not notice it as Android users. It does not faze us.
It's fabricated grouping. It's a
you're gray and green. Everyone on my phone is gray and green.
But
there's
no
different
colors.
You don't
notice it because you don't get the fucking messages.
Yeah.
Which I hate to say it is that you're a victim of excellent marketing and branding on
yep.
the case of Apple.
Okay, so tell me what is the root of the word podcast?
I have no idea.
It's from iPod.
Oh, okay.
It has to be, right?
Yeah, it's because they originally started it at Apple iTunes, and then the podcast started and it became a thing, and people
Oh, I just learned something.
I believe that's what it is.
Yeah. I believe that's what it is. That's why I dropped that there.
What is the point?
Your phone sucks.
Even though he loves it.
So
I'm super jealous of the fact that it can fold and unfold. I would love the new Razer, but to me, it's a software issue. It's like the interactivity. So to me, these things now are tools. I know a lot of people, I used to get this and be like, I needed the latest one, or I want the coolest new thing. I specifically got the small one because I'm like, this is a tool for me now. This no longer means anything to me. I need to make phone calls, text messages, check an email, and maybe check numbers on things. That's all I need. So I don't need to carry
there's
a giant-ass
computer
around me.
There's never been an issue of something I can't do on this phone. I've never had an issue of like, I just can't do it because it's an Android. It's never happened once.
Do you notice, though, that I really noticed that, and I think it's an iPhone thing. I'm waffling all over the place here, trying to make fun of Allie. But she's like, when you make fun of Allie, like her first instinct is to fuck.
I get defensive. I can't help it.
She bites back.
I do bite.
Right? And I'm like a pussy that I'm like, I'm so easily intimidated. So I was
but
trying.
But you
to,
love doing it.
I was trying to cue it up here, and I've already lost. But anyway, but have you noticed that cell phone audio call? Like a cellular phone call, right? Like the technology has gone back like 5 or more years. Like making a phone call sucks now. I find.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you use. Like I know.
Sounds like you need an Android.
No,
I have
but
no
you and I try to talk on the phone sometimes and it doesn't work.
That's because I live in the woods.
Yeah, well.
Well, let me ask you. Do you what service do you have on your
T-Mobile?
T-Mobile, and what do you have?
AT&T.
Yeah, so I think within certain networks, they work better than others, but I don't know what I mean. It, to me, it's the infrastructure, right? This thing became so popular. These devices became so popular so quickly that telecommunication companies are desperately trying to one up each other and expand their infrastructure in a way that they can't keep up with.
I just think a voice call has gone back in time.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah,
yeah.
You should get an Android. I have no problems with my car.
Yeah, I just tried making a phone call earlier to somebody today, and they were driving through like upstate New York, and I'm just like, why can't I hear you? You're in New York.
Yeah, like, I live in the middle of nowhere. Like one time, my old boss came to drop off a check at my house, and he was like, it was during the pandemic, and he's like, I'm gonna drop your paycheck off in your mailbox because we're not allowed to be in contact. And he got there and he texted me and he's like, I did not know you lived in the middle of nowhere. He was like upset. He was like, I got lost because you live in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, I live in a very wooded middle of nowhere area. Oh,
so jealous.
So the times on the podcast has been sort of interesting, and everybody has their weird things that they get hung up on, right? So when we first released, I had a buddy of mine that has been listening to podcasts, and mm-hmm. this is what made me think of podcast and the root of the word, which is something that we should probably look up because it's kind of interesting again. But he had told me that his theory was that the lengthier, when you start getting into the podcasts, the people of some more successful podcasts have really got into like the really long ones. And,
yeah.
You know, then we start talking about like this like deep dive sort of thing, which we've mentioned in other episodes, and they're really lengthy and stuff. So we set the timer that we just shut off, right? For 58 yeah. minutes.
I feel like we haven't really gotten to the meat of things yet. So.
Well, and then I was looking at some of the episodes. Like we have one that's actually really short. It's like only like 38 minutes or something, which we must have. I don't know. Allie must have edited something out or something. I don't know. It's like so. And then we have like Michael Moreway was like an hour and 12 or hour yeah. and 18 minutes or something. But Allie can't stop worrying about the length. She
in the beginning I was really worried.
No. Never, she's still worried.
I just turned it off. I don't care.
She's worried, though.
In the beginning, I was so worried because I just never had done a podcast. I didn't know anything about that.
I think it's important to be cognizant of the time in the beginning because that could be a barrier to entry, right?
Yeah.
So that could be a thing where people are like, oh, my God, this is so long. I don't know if I want to get into it. But then once you get into what you were saying, like successful ones get longer and longer. Like
yeah.
Call Her Daddy is a great example. Their stuff was like all over the place in the beginning, and now it's just like these deep conversations.
Well, Ari was just like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. So we used it as a tool at first to sort of gauge like what we were doing and where we were going with it. But then Allie has like been hung up on it. Look at her. She's gonna fucking rip me apart. she was so concerned about it. And I'm like, why are you so concerned about it? And I was like, Ari doesn't care. Let it rip.
But here's the thing. Here's a fun way to look at it. If you're concerned about the time, whether you are or not, and it's long, make it two parts.
Yeah, that's true. We could do two parts.
Here's part one, part two.
Yeah,
and then like, that also saves you further down the road.
Look, we're learning so much. I love this.
I never stop teaching.
Pablo never stops teaching me. It's incredible.
He's going to teach you how to get an iPhone.
No.